Hello, this is Terrence McNally, and welcome to Freeform, a world that just might work. I've gone deep into the archives for this 2004 conversation with Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates on his television project, America Behind the Color Line, and the persistence of racism in a black underclass. Despite gains by an African-American middle class, the percentage of black children in poverty was about the same at that time as the day Martin Luther King was assassinated. I think it's helpful to go back now and then to past conversations to help us understand how we got where we are today. When today's guest enrolled at Yale University in September of 1969, he was one of 96 black men and women in that class. By contrast, the class of 1966 had included only 6 black male graduates. Henry Louis Gates Jr. points out that he was part of what came to be called the affirmative action generation. And what has happened since then? Well, the black middle class has tripled as measured by the percentage of families earning $50,000 or more. At the same time, however, the percentage of black children who live at or below the poverty line is almost 35%, just about what it was on the day that Dr. Martin Luther King was killed. Since the late 60s, then, two distinct classes have emerged within black America: a black middle class with white money, as his mother used to say, and what some would argue is a self-perpetuating black underclass. Is this what the civil rights movement was all about? Can we ever bridge this black class divide? Here on Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect hold pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Henry Louis Gates Jr. is one of the most prominent and well-known academics in the United States today. He's the W.E.B. Du Bois Professor of Humanities and the chair of Harvard's African American Studies Program, general editor of the Norton Anthology of African American Literature, co-editor of Africana, the Encyclopedia of the African American Experience, and editor of The Bond Woman's Narrative by Hannah Crafts. Gates is also the author of The African American Century, How Black America Has Shaped Our Country, and 13 Ways of Looking at a Black Man, among others. Additionally, he narrated the 6-hour PBS documentary series, Wonders of the African World. He's a recipient of a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, a regular contributor to The New Yorker. His newest book is the companion to a PBS series which debuts tonight all across the country on PBS, America Behind the Color Line. The book is called America Behind the Color Line, Dialogues with African Americans. Welcome, Henry Louis Gates Jr. to KPFK and Freeform.
Thanks, Terry. It's great to be on your program.
Okay. First, I always want to ask a little bit about the personal path to the work that my guests do. I want listeners to get a little feel for the person behind the ideas and the work. So, how did you end up in academia and in African American studies?
Well, I was a poor colored boy, solidly working class. I was born in 1950. I was raised by a mother who was a self-esteem machine. I mean, my mother told my brother and me every day of our lives that we were beautiful and that we were brilliant. Now, she might have lied, or maybe one out of two is not bad. You might, you have to decide which is which.
And my radio doesn't tell.
That's right. And my dad, who's 90 years old, it was 90 on June 8th, my dad worked 2 jobs for 37 years to put my brother and me through college. In fact, we certainly were the most prosperous black family in Piedmont, West Virginia, because my dad worked in the factory in the day and he was a janitor in the evening. And that little extra margin, you know, put us in the sort of the upper middle class of the poor people, as it were. In fact, I didn't know I was poor until I went off to Yale and took a sociology course. And I said, wow, look at that poor people. That's me.
Right. But same thing happened when I went to Harvard, actually.
Really? Yep. But I was raised in absolute economic and familial security. There was never any question that my brother and I were going to college. My brother is a very successful oral surgeon. He's the chief of oral surgery at Bronx Lebanon Hospital in New York, and he's 5 years older, and there's little old me bringing up the rear. But my mama wanted 2 doctors. I mean, being a doctor in the black community was like being the closest position to God that you could have. I mean, it garnered one dignity, economic security, a tremendous amount of respect, and fluidity, mobility. One could pick up and leave. White racists came in. You could always take your shingle and your bag and get the hell out of town. And so I, until I was 25, I still played with the idea of going to medical school. And for a brief time, I even went to law school. I attended Yale Law School after I graduated from Yale. Then I went off to the University of Cambridge, enrolled in a PhD program, came back in the middle of my graduate education, went to Yale Law School for 6 weeks, and then took a leave of absence. And the last time I checked, I was still on leave. It was when I went to the University of Cambridge that I realized that what I wanted to be all along was a person of letters, that I wanted to be a scholar. I discovered James Baldwin, or an Episcopal priest had discovered James Baldwin for me in the summer of 1965 at an Episcopal church camp. And that, you remember, was the summer of Watts. It was August 65, and we were in Romney, West Virginia, the Diocese of West Virginia's statewide church camp. And all these Negroes are rioting in some place called Watts. I didn't know if that meant white people were killing black people. I didn't know what Watts was. I barely knew what L.A. was in 1965. And a very sensitive Episcopal priest, white, of course, handed me a copy of this book. And I looked down and saw this black man staring back at me from the cover of the book. And it was a book called Notes of a Native Son by someone called James Baldwin. And I fell in love with James Baldwin, his prose, the book, the act of writing. I had always read widely, but I'd never read a book before by a black man. Now, I was so geared to being a doctor that reading English and American literature and then African-American literature, because Baldwin led to Malcolm X's autobiography and books by Dr. King, Eldridge Cleaver's The Soul on Ice, Claude Brown's Manchild in the Promised Land.
I was waiting for that one.
You know, I'm just on fire with these books. And I would read them, and then my dad would read them. And we had big arguments about them. So this was an avocation. My real vocation was going to be a doctor. And then I started collecting examples of doctors who had become creative writers. William Carlos Williams, Arthur Conan Doyle. So I was thinking, well, maybe I'll be the first black doctor who dabbles on the side as a writer. But I graduated from Yale, and I was very blessed, as our people say, and I did very well. And I got a fellowship to go to the University of Cambridge. In fact, I got a Mellon Fellowship. I was the first African-American to get a Mellon Fellowship. And when I hurried home to tell my parents, see, I'd wanted all my life from the 50s, I'd wanted to be a Rhodes Scholar. I'd wanted to go to Oxford or Cambridge. I wanted to go to Harvard or Yale, Oxford and Cambridge. When other people were fantasizing about being Hank Aaron or Willie Mays, I wanted to be a Rhodes Scholar. And I got this fellowship. So I rushed back to Calhoun College at Yale. That's Yale's name for dorms. And I called my parents, and it was the middle of my senior year. And I said, Mama, Daddy, you know, they were on both phones. I said, you'd never believe it. I got a Mellon Fellowship. I got a Mellon Fellowship. I'm the first African-American to get a Mellon Fellowship. And my daddy said, you're the first Negro to get a Mellon Fellowship. I said, yeah. He said, huh, they're going to call it the Watermelon Fellowship from now. So armed with my Watermelon Fellowship,
yeah,
I went to Cambridge, and there I met two Africans who changed my life. I mean, people say this all the time, but in my case, it was literally true. One was a Nigerian playwright in exile, and his name was Wole Soyinka. And this was 1973, and of course, 13 years later, in 1986, he would become the first African to get the Nobel Prize for Literature. The other was a young African prince named Kwame Anthony Appiah, who became instantly my best friend and still is my best friend. And he was such a scholar. He's so brilliant. I mean, he's the most brilliant person I've ever met. I mean, African, non-African, black, white, red, yellow, or any other color. I mean, he's a genius and an aristocrat on his English side and his African side. And he had just left medical school, 1 year of medical school, to become a philosopher. And his mind was so sublime. And there I had these two examples of these two Africans who were men of letters. And I realized all along, from that day in the middle of August 1965, when the black people were rioting in Watts, and this priest gave me this book he thought to comfort me, that I really fell in love with the idea of being a writer, a man of letters, and a scholar. And fortunately, I was at a place, Cambridge, where I could enroll in a PhD program in English literature, and I became the first African-American to take the PhD in English from the University of Cambridge. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Wow. I mean, I'm really glad you shared that. One thing is that when I do ask that question, so often it is someone they met along the way.
Mm-hmm. Mentors.
Mentors, models.
Mentors don't have to look like us, by the way. You know, you don't need a black mentor if you're black. You just need a mentor, someone who cares about you. Someone, I call it the laying on of hands. Someone says, Terry, you have the stuff.
Yeah.
And it's someone you respect, and you say, really? And you go, yeah. For me, when I was an undergraduate, it was a man, a great American historian called John Morton Blum. And he was a Jewish man. I'm saying that in the context of
mentorship.
But to get tenure at Yale, he was the first Jewish person to get tenure at Yale in the history department. And he told me that to get tenure at Yale, he had to convert to the Episcopal Church. And he used to make a joke that the first Jew with tenure at Yale in the history department is an Episcopalian. He busts out laughing. But and he told me always about the necessity of protecting my ethnic identity. Like, you know, you can't stay mired in it. You can't ghettoize yourself. But you need to wear it, to use it, to understand it, and then to move from it as a foundation, to move from it into the larger world. And that's pretty much been my model for how I've chosen to function. As I say in the preface to my memoir, Color People, sushi and fried catfish.
It's funny. I left the book signing last night, went over and had those. There's a buffet right near Esuan Books.
Oh, you did? Oh, that's great. You should have taken me with you. I signed all those books.
We'd have had fun.
Yeah.
You're listening to Free Forum on KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming globally on the web at www.kpfk.org. I'm your host, Terry McNally, and I'm speaking with Henry Louis Gates, Jr., chair of Harvard's African American Studies Program, general editor of the Norton Anthology of African-American literature, which, given what you've just told us, must have been such an honor and responsibility.
Oh, man. And, you know, that's the best-selling trade book in the history of Norton Anthologies. And trade book, by the way, means the hardback. And the reason why is because so many members of the black middle class bought it as a piece of intellectual furniture. You go into homes and it's on the coffee table. Or Karen Grigsby Bates, the great journalist on NPR, and I were in Louisville last week, and she interviewed me in front of this large audience as part of the book tour. And she told me that the first year that it came out, she got four copies independently as Christmas presents. And that's why. It's 2,500 pages of the entire African-American literary tradition, and we just published the second edition, and it has two CDs in it. So we have the oral tradition. We have poets, black writers reading like Toni Morrison or Mary Baraka. And we have the oral literature. We even have Aretha Franklin and John Coltrane and then black people signifying and playing the dozens. It's really good. We revolutionized the way anthologies were produced because ours was the first anthology in history with a CD-ROM. Remember in school when you took out a library book and there was that little envelope glued to the back?
Yeah, little pocket.
Our CDs glued to the back of the inside dust jacket.
And, well, I'm glad that I mentioned it because that is something that some listeners may have missed.
Yeah.
And worth picking up, and you're saying a new edition. So that's the Norton Anthology of African American Literature. Now, his newest book is the companion to a PBS series which debuts tonight all around the country, America Behind the Color Line. And the book adds a subtitle. I love subtitles. Yeah. Movies and TV miss that.
Yeah,
subtitles
that's
true. Are great.
I'm a footnote man, too, but that's another conversation.
Dialogues with African Americans. And to learn more, you can go to www.pbs.org. Okay, what was the origin of this project?
Well, 1900, W.E.B. Du Bois, the greatest black intellectual of all time, pronounced famously that the problem of the 20th century would be the problem of the color line. So at the beginning of the 21st century, I wanted to ask, what will the problem of the 21st century be for the African-American community? But unlike the lordly Du Bois who sat down at his desk and just made the pronouncement, I wanted to travel around the country interviewing a cross-section of the African-American community for one of the first times. A very, very few books consist of interviews with the rich and famous and most prominent African-Americans, but also prisoners in the Cook County Jail, single heads of household in the inner city, drug dealers, soon to be drug dealers all over again. Black people in the North who are reverse migrating to the South. But Quincy Jones, Maya Angelou, Chris Tucker, Bernie Mac, Alicia Keys. I mean, everybody's in here. I mean, a representative sample. And I wanted to ask our people, how are we doing as a community 35 years after the tragic death of Martin Luther King? And your opening lines, which quoting my work in the introduction, said...
I steal from the best.
No, that's great. I was very flattered. It's you're absolutely right. It's the best of times. It's the worst of times for the African-American community. Under segregation, at least, we had a unity of culture and purpose and neighborhood. We all lived in the same neighborhood. Now, the black middle class, which is almost quadrupled because of affirmative action, has moved out into other middle class and upper middle class neighborhoods, leaving behind an inner city of despair and hopelessness. The black poor are perpetuating themselves, and the black middle class is perpetuating itself. And unless we do something drastic, both systemically or structurally on the one hand, and internally as black people individually, on the other hand, never the twain shall meet. In other words, the principal outcome of the civil rights movement has been to create a phenomenal amount of success for a small number of us and leave behind everyone else. Why? Well, one of the things that emerges from the interviews is that everyone understands, and this is to my astonishment, whether it was that prisoner in the Cook County Jail or the single heads of household, you know, women in their 20s with six children, men who had essentially dropped out of school in the eighth grade and become drug runners and then drug users and then drug dealers and then criminals. They all understand this on one level or another, what I'm about to say, that the causes of poverty are both structural and behavioral. They are the result of historical forces like slavery for 300 years and then followed by a century of de jure segregation, systematic institutional racism. So how do you counter that? We need a sophisticated jobs program that gives people a stake in the system again. We need an effective Marshall Plan for our cities. If we can rebuild Iraq, which remains to be seen,
yes.
You tell me we can't rebuild South Central? We can't rebuild Harlem? We can't rebuild Huff and Bed-Stuy? Of course we can't. We just have to have the will. But at the same time, no white racist makes you get pregnant when you're 16. No white racist makes you do drugs. No white racist, this to me is the worst nightmare, makes you not do your homework, not learn the ABCs, your multiplication tables, not attend classes, act out in school. This is ridiculous. When I was growing up, the blackest thing you could be was an educated person, not a basketball player. The blackest thing you could be was Thurgood Marshall, Mary McLeod Bethune, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. These were the true heroes of our people. The idea that education would become white or intellectual success would become white is an idea that turns my stomach. And we need a revolution in the black community where we learn to defer gratification, keep our behinds in the classroom, do our homework, learn our algebra, and realize that the next face of the civil rights movement is education for the black community itself. We also need to register and vote and stop complaining. Look, there's nothing wrong with complaining when there's something to complain about, but we can't. It's like, remember Flip Wilson? The devil made me do it. What is that? White racists made me do it? White racists? This is not saving our people, and we can't. Too many of our leaders romanticize this. It's so easy for us all to agree about how evil white racists are. Hey, I'm down with that. You show me racism, I will pounce on it with all four. But I don't want any excuses anymore. Our people are dying. Our community is dying. Our culture is dying because of the profound chasm in class, the class divide between the black haves and the black have-nots. And this book is a wake-up call to the black poor and the black rich, to white America, to the White House and the Congress. The most pressing problem facing America is not in the Middle East. It is in our inner cities. It is the way that poverty is corrupting American culture and leading to two nations. And very few of the presidential candidates are talking about the real issue. And the real issue is economics.
Well, let's be fair. I thought you were going to say, is this race divide? I was going to say, when the first two primaries are in Iowa and New Hampshire, they're not going to talk a lot about race.
Right. That's true. Yeah, but 96% of New Hampshire, I heard yesterday, 96% is white.
And you got to bet Iowa ain't far off that.
No, that's right.
And it's interesting that they have so much power.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't know. I mean, it's older than the current situation, but it certainly is something. One thing I notice is that what you're saying when you're talking about when I was growing up, what the models are now, what people aspire to. I mean, I thought of like Urkel. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, Urkel, sure.
Urkel should be a hero,
that's
right?
Urkel was the nerd. We need more nerds in the black community, not less. My father, who's so hilarious, my father, on his 90th birthday, we had a birthday party for him. So I asked him in front of these people, Daddy, what do you want? What is your fondest ambition for your 90th birthday? And he said, boy, I want to bump Bob Dole off that Viagra commercial. He's got a 77-year-old girlfriend. I mean, that's my dad. My dad, when I was a professor at Duke, where I was for 2 years, my dad, near my house was a basketball court. And it was, you know, full of black people all day long. You go to bed at midnight. It was well lit. It was packed. Wake up the next day. It was packed. I don't know if those guys played all night, but they were on the basketball court. And one night, my dad said, if we studied calculus like we studied basketball, we'd be running MIT. And I busted out laughing, but it's true.
You've given some statistics about checking the percent, the number of...
Absolutely. And I did a piece in Sports Illustrated in 1991. I don't have the stats here with me for the 2000
for today,
census. But in the year 1990, according to the federal census, The total number of black lawyers, doctors, dentists, and professional athletes were as follows. There were 20,000 or so black lawyers. There were 14,000 black doctors. There were 5,600 black dentists. And you ready for this? There were 1,200 black professional athletes. But the average person, white or black, believes there are 100,000 black athletes and 10,000 black doctors. You know, we think that it's easier to be in the NBA than to be a brain surgeon. As a matter of fact, it is not. Statistically, it is not. It is easier to get into Harvard Medical School than to get into the NBA. This is wrong. Our culture has been perverted by the pursuit of sports. I love sports. I love the Final Four. I love the NBA championship. I love the Super Bowl. I love the Olympics. I like field and track. What's not to like? But don't confuse that with success. What's the average career lifespan of an athlete? 5 years?
Yeah.
You know, if you're Grant Hill or Michael Jordan, great. Or Kobe Bryant, stay out of those hotel rooms. But, you know, but if you can get a fantastic contract, more power to you. But so many kids, even in my own family, I've seen this. I'm going to be a professional football player. I'm going to be when I get there, I'm going to thank my Lord Jesus, buy my mama a house. I must have heard black people say that a million times.
Yeah.
And you know what they end up doing? Driving taxis because they didn't make it. They have no education. They have been educated to major in basketball.
Yeah.
They have been educated to major in football. And I think that the some of the biggest criminals in American society are the coaches and the sports establishment who exploit black athletes like the gladiators in ancient Rome. These are just interchangeable parts, and they're going to be eaten by the lions anyway, so who cares? Feed them, give them a little money, and they have a lifespan. 5 years, the lion's going to eat them. What's the lion? Their body's going to fall apart, or they're going to get hurt, or they're just going to be supplanted by someone who's better.
And at the shortest sight, the fact is that the money that they make selling $100, $150 tennis basketball shoes to ghetto kids
right.
is already making up for whatever they pay those few that make it. Let me tell people that you're listening to Free Forum on KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming on the web at www.kpfk.org. I'm Terry McNally, and I'm speaking with Henry Louis Gates, Jr., chair of Harvard's African American Studies program, general editor of the Norton Anthology of African American Literature, which is out in a new edition. His newest book is the companion to a PBS series which debuts tonight and runs
February 3rd and February 4th, 2 hours tonight and 2 hours tomorrow night.
And that is America Behind the Color Line. It's interviews he did around the country with African Americans. To learn more about that, you can go to www.pbs.org. And I want to mention one other thing, given the date of today's show. The 12th Annual Pan-African Film and Arts Festival at Magic Johnson Theaters and the Baldwin Hills Crenshaw Plaza starts February 5th and runs the 5th through the 16th. And you can learn more about that at www.paff, that's FF as in Frank, .org. And there's someone, by the way, who did both. Magic Johnson.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Did the athletic thing.
And he was a smart man, and he invested well, and he's very, very successful.
And he brings it back home, right?
Yeah, he does. I mean, look how he transforms inner city through his investments. I mean, I went to, when I was making this film series, which I shot in the summer of 2002, so I'm out in L.A. because one segment's called Black Hollywood.
Right.
And so I was thirsty, dying for a cup of coffee. It was 11 o'clock in the morning, and we were with the film crew, and I looked over, and there was a Starbucks. I walked in. This is unbeknownst to me. At first, I thought, well, you know, where am I? Is this the moon or Mars or something? Everybody in there was black. I mean, I have never been in a Starbucks where everybody was black. And I looked up, and there were pictures of Magic all over. And I said, wow, this is Magic Johnson Starbucks. And it was really good. It was almost like a community center. Now, I like Magic. I don't know him personally, but I admire him enormously. And I wish him all the best of health. I hope the brother lives a long, long time.
We've got five more minutes. It's amazing how this stuff flies by. I mean, I used to do an hour show. I dream of when I get it back.
Oh, you deserve it, man. You I would listen to you for an hour anytime.
Thank you.
Even if I weren't on it.
Let me ask you, Dr. Gates, we've talked about the diagnosis a little bit, and the prognosis is up in the air. What's the treatment?
The treatment is twofold. We need to give people, we need to change the context in which black people are making the choices in which they live, meaning they need to know. Just like you knew, Terry, and like I knew, that down the road was economic opportunity. If only I stayed on the follow the yellow brick road and you'll get to Oz. My mother told me that. My father told me that. He said, along the way, there'll be these white racist obstacles. You got to be 10 times smarter than the white man, my daddy would say. He'd say, 10 times smarter than the white boy. Get those straight A's. And if you do, you're helping Dr. King and them, as we would say, you know, that you were helping to fight the civil rights movement by getting straight A's. So I was like a warrior in the classroom for my people. And I also loved it. I mean, it was, it's like I bathed in education. I loved education. I loved everything about school. And I loved books. I loved the smell of books. I loved to hold books. I loved to read books. I was just a junkie for learning. And that became so because of my parents. But look, if you're 16 and you can't read yourself, how can you create an atmosphere where education is valorized, is prized?
So you're talking about the 16-year-old who's having children.
Yeah, our babies are having babies. Nobody is mature enough to have a child in their teens, in my humble opinion. I wasn't mature enough at 30 when we had our first child. I might not be mature enough now at 53.
And one thing I think is that, you know, centuries ago, people had children at that age.
But they died when they were 30 or 40.
And they also lived in a community
where
you weren't on your own.
Right. But now it's you have the average age of a grandmother in Robert Taylor Holmes a few years ago was mid-30s. A grandmother. This is not a sight for hope and optimism. But at the same time that we need to give people a stake in the system through a sophisticated jobs program, drastic reform of our schools. Our schools are armed camps. I couldn't have thrived in the inner city. You know, I went into homes, I went into schools when I made this film series. I could not have, even with my parents, it would have been difficult for me to thrive and to survive in that atmosphere. So we need that kind of reform, but we also need moral reform. Attitudinal reform within the black community. We need to stop making bad choices. Too many of us have internalized our oppression. We are perpetuating our own poverty. You know, we need to work hard, stay in school, defer gratification, avoid the bling bling, believe in the future. And if we do both things simultaneously, if the leadership class in the black community beats up on George Bush, the White House, and the Congress, and demands the creation of a federal jobs program, because we can't stand the idea that so many of our people are left behind, mired in poverty. And then we turn the cannon on members of the black community and you gangs, you have to stop what you're doing. You know, we arrest these kids. We need to have prison reform. We need to let out people who are in prison on drug-related crimes who should be treated in medical facilities. So many of our black males, when I traveled around the south side of Chicago, I kept wondering, where are the black males? When I went to Cook County Jail, I found out where they are. They're the University of the Cook County Prison.
Now, it's 33% of every black male between 18 and 35, I think.
Well, in Chicago, it's 20%. 1 in 5 black men are in prison on probation or parole.
Okay.
And in 1990, there were 2,280,000 black men in prison on probation or parole. 23,000 got a college degree. That's a ratio of 99-1. You know what the ratio for the same figures of white males was? 6-1. Our people are being killed by, our culture is being killed by the culture, how can I put it? The poor cultural choices, the poor individual behavioral choices that so many people in our culture are making because they feel they have no hope. As Cornel West puts it, they're living a nihilistic existence. And we have to give them hope again. But simultaneously, and this is important, we have to insist that they seize the opportunities that are opening up for them.
How do you see that happening?
We need our leaders to stop romanticizing bad behavior. Our church leaders, the leaders of mosque, Jesse Jackson, even Farrakhan, Al Sharpton, wherever the leader might be, whatever their ideological persuasion might be, we need them united, whether they are running the Deltas, the Kappas, the great fraternities and sororities, the Alphas, or Jack and Jill clubs. Jack and Jill clubs should be Black History Club, not Black Sadidi Club.
Okay, we got to pull it to a close.
Oh,
as I said, it flew by, but the book is America Behind the Color Line. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 to 10 articles to kind of flesh out the conversation, you can sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes and many other podcast sites. You can find years of podcasts at my site. That's, you know, Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to G. Lee and Mark Maxwell in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. Most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Henry Louis Gates, Jr. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Terry.